This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. It's time once again to discuss this past week's important news with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be here.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Greetings.
This past week, there was a meeting of 60 nations at the Warsaw Mideast Summit, co-sponsored by America and Poland, and attended by Israel and several Arab states. A lot of interesting takeaways from this meeting. To hear about it, we'll turn to Brent.
I think the mainstream media's reporting on this has been pretty horrific because it's kind of stating that the United States is there. They're trying to gather all these nations together to say why Iran is such a bad actor, and nobody really wants to attend this meeting, and it's going to be a failure, and no one really agrees with the United States. Well, it turns out that a lot of nations agree with the United States, especially of those in the Middle East. And in terms of this, the fact that shows this is that the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was there, and the Arab states knew he was going to be there. Arab states that don't have diplomatic relations with Israel, they haven't had them ever. And yet they knew that they were going to have a sit down at a table with an Israeli prime minister there. And to show you how, like, this is just out of this world, the Yemeni foreign minister was actually put right next to Benjamin Netanyahu in one of these meetings, and he was sitting right next to him. And when he got home, he had to put out a statement saying that to suppress his people, who obviously the populations in the Middle East, they don't really like Israel, but the leadership knows that Israel is on their side, you see. He had to put out a statement that says, well, they got it wrong in Warsaw. There was a mix-up. I wasn't meant to be sitting next to the prime minister. Don't worry. We still don't like Israel. We still support the Palestinians. That's what they have to say in the public to make sure there's no revolt with their people. But behind closed doors, this meeting was stunning. You had a lot of Arab states, including the Saudi foreign minister, the Bahraini foreign minister, the United Arab Emirates foreign minister, all agreeing that the Palestinian issue is not the big deal anymore. It's Iran. And if Iran would get its fingers out of the Palestinian issue, we might actually solve it.
Yeah, so tell us about the evidence of this. There was quite extraordinary evidence of some of the statements from some of these Arab leaders stating exactly what you just said.
Right, so they wouldn't do it with the press there, obviously, because that would get back to their peoples. But there was a leaked video of one of these discussions that took place with the foreign ministers of Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Bahrain. Dennis Ross, the former U.S. negotiator, he was chairing this discussion. Prime Minister Netanyahu was in the crowd of other leaders, as well as the U.S. and European foreign ministers. They were there sitting. So it's just foreign ministers there and their aides listening to this. And it ends up getting made public. And this is what the foreign minister of the United Arab Emirates said. He said, in a response to Israelis fighting against the Iranians in Syria, he said, every nation has the right to defend itself when it is challenged by another nation. Yes, Israel has the right to fight against Iran. Israel has the right to suppress Iran. Bahraini foreign minister says this, we grew up talking about the Israeli-Palestine issue as the most important issue. That has to be solved one way or another. But then at a later stage, we saw a bigger challenge. We saw a more toxic one. In fact, the more toxic one in our history. And that came from the Islamic Republic. And then we had the Bahraini foreign minister said this. He talked about, first of all, that this is still the Bahraini minister. He said, talking about the challenge that we have to face is Iran, not the Palestinian issue right now. And then the Saudi foreign minister said this, we cannot stabilize the region without peace between Israelis and Palestinians. But wherever we go, we find Iran's evil behavior. And so Benjamin Netanyahu was just sitting there listening to all of this. Mm-hmm. And he no doubt had known that this was what those leaders thought previous to this. But for him to be sitting in the room, for the Europeans to be all sitting in the room and hearing what those nations feel in the region about Iran should be somewhat of a wake-up call that everyone in the region is concerned. Iran is making allies out of historic enemies, the Arab states and Israel. And they're all banding together, it seems, right now, for at least the time being, to counter Iran.
Now, just before we get to the substance of those remarks, I just wonder, and you may or may not know, but did Benjamin Netanyahu, say, take a risk in leaking this video when you have these Arab leaders who are taking such a risk by even attending a meeting where he's there? If this gets out to their people, even if they're putting out these public pronouncements, well, I wasn't supposed to be sitting next to him, but and yet they hear this type of rhetoric from their mouths directly, what sort of position does that put them in?
I think it does put them in a hard position, at least for the time being. Prime Minister Netanyahu probably did this too for political gain. The fact that he's sitting down with all these people that are saying pro-Israeli things will be very good for him in terms of Israel's election coming up in April. So he probably leaked it for that reason. Nevertheless, it was good to expose this for the rest of the world, I think, that Iran really is a factor. And Europe right now, you're off base. You're out of step, not just with the United States in terms of Iran. You're in off step in terms of everybody else in the Middle East as well.
Well, put this in context for us, because it was actually quite interesting. I guess Europe did not attend largely. There were several European powers who could have and opted out. The fact that you're hearing this message from these Arab states, just put this in prophetic context for us.
Right. So the Bible speaks about in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40, how the beginning of the Great Tribulation, just before that, we have this clash that takes place between the king of the south and the king of the north. And the king of the south is the power that instigates it. It pushes the king of the north to respond. And we've talked about for about 20 years that this king of the south is this radical Islamic empire or kingdom led by Iran that is going to find allies in other nations and already has it already has allies in other nations. They are going to be pushing Europe, the king of the north, to finally respond. And what's interesting just about this, I mean, if you wanted a public declaration of where we are in Bible prophecy, this conference should be it. 60 nations gathering together to basically say the king of the south is here in prophetic terms, and what are we going to do about it? That's what it's about. If you're talking about the Bible prophecy, they are there. They're worried about how to handle Iran. The Europeans, although there were plenty that did show up. Again, mainstream media wants to report that the Europeans were totally against this. All the reporting from Israel coming out from the discussions is that the Europeans had no objection to these discussions about Iran, especially in terms of the nuclear deal aside, all the other aspects of what Iran is doing, because they're facing Iran, obviously, with the assassination attempts that Iran is doing on European soil, the ballistic missile program that Iran has, increasing its missile launch, the range of those to reach southern Europe, the comments that even the Ayatollah said the same day, so that he doesn't trust the Europeans. I think it's not long before the Europeans turn around in this. Of course, they're weighing up the option of siding with the United States, which is not good for a lot of them, their own positions in power, since European populations are generally against Mr. Donald Trump. So they're weighing that.
But this also demonstrates that they have a lot of allies in the Middle East as well that they can align with. And that's very much consistent with prophecy.
Yeah, I think give it a couple more days and we might see some more pro-European responses that are coming out in the news as well.
Anywhere that you would send people for more information about this?
Yeah, I people need to read the King of the South booklet. It is dynamite that talks about why Iran pushes at Europe. It talks about how they're going to do this. And this prophecy, as I said, is being brought in front of our eyes through this conference just this week.
Pretty electrifying stuff. We appreciate that very much, Brent. Well, there is ample evidence that Chinese companies have sold technology to U.S. companies aimed at carrying out cyber espionage, threatening America's security. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, a report from the White House said on Thursday that the U.S. is now preparing an executive order that will ban Huawei equipment from being used on American telecommunications networks. Huawei is a Chinese company. It's a manufacturer of phones and other telecommunications equipment. You could sort of think of it as China's Apple, except it's bigger. It's actually the world's largest telecommunications company. And the U.S. and other powers are coming to see how dangerous it is to let this Chinese company become kind of entwined with their nation's technologies just because of the risk of cyber espionage, of spying, and also of intellectual property theft. And this news about the ban comes just a couple of weeks after the U.S. Justice Department announced a long list of criminal charges against Huawei, mostly related to the way the company has systematically stolen trade secrets from American companies. These charges were related, for the most part, to Huawei stealing intellectual property from T-Mobile, and that included T-Mobile's proprietary phone testing technology. There's also evidence that Huawei promised really hefty bonuses to any employees who were able to gather confidential information from T-Mobile. And those Huawei employees were encouraged to send photos and spec sheets. One Huawei employee even was caught stealing the arm of a robot, you know, apparently a piece of high-tech, as yet unreleased technology. So Huawei, as I mentioned, is the world's largest manufacturer of telecommunications equipment, and we're now seeing one of the big reasons why they have grown so large and so powerful. It's because they've stolen so much from U.S. companies.
So the U.S. is targeting this specific company, but this is hardly the only evidence of Chinese espionage against the United States.
That's exactly right. For more than a decade, Chinese theft of American commercial technology and intellectual property of all kinds has become really one of the main pillars of China's economic growth. In addition to this Huawei case, the Chinese have also been caught stealing secrets regarding DRAM chips and jet engines, wind turbines, biopharmaceutical products, and a lot of other things as well. And even when China's operatives are caught, as they have been with this Huawei case, the nation's leadership, for the most part, maintains this same strategy. I've got a quote here from John Bennett. He heads up the FBI's San Francisco office, and he told the LA Times, quote, "The Chinese leadership don't care if they get caught or if people go to jail. As long as it justifies their ends, they're not going to stop." So it is it's a really deeply entrenched strategy for China. And experts say that altogether, China's intellectual property theft costs America between $225 billion each year and $600 billion each year.
So certainly intellectual property theft is something where you're talking about how much China is benefiting economically from this, but there's also quite the potential for sabotage and more overt acts of aggression by China against the United States if they are able to infiltrate systems. Can you just talk a bit about the evidence that some of the techniques that they're using could really hurt the United States?
There have been reports that the Chinese have planted secret chips on certain products that are sold and incorporated into American technology, and these would essentially be a backdoor that could, you know, some say could allow the Chinese at some point down the road to even take over command of vital American infrastructure, including some military technologies. So, the idea of that is just really chilling. And just the fact that these companies are, you know, the competitor companies to China. So they're able to take what makes the American companies have a technological edge and what they've spent billions on in many cases for R&D, and they steal that, they pilfer it, and then they compete against those very companies with it.
So looking at this from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, this is really something that this kind of espionage or these kinds of attacks against the United States fulfills really some pretty specific prophecies.
It really does. Yes, it's Deuteronomy 28 mentions some specific ways that God promised that he would bless Israel if they obeyed him, and some specific ways that he said he would punish Israel if they rejected him. And Israel here refers mainly to the U.S. and Britain, which is explained really thoroughly in Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury's book, Isaiah's End Time Vision. And one of the specific curses recorded in Deuteronomy 28, verse 33, says the fruits of these nations' labor would be stolen and consumed by an outside power. The scripture says, "The fruit of your land and all your labors shall a nation which you know not eat up, and you shall be only oppressed and crushed always." So it's a very specific warning, and this is what is happening now. You know, America's rejecting God. That's evident in every part of society that you look at. And as a result, God is letting the fruits of U.S. labor be stolen and consumed by Huawei and other Chinese entities, exactly as he warned that he would in this prophecy in Deuteronomy.
Where could people learn more about these prophecies, Jeremiah?
Well, I would recommend Isaiah's End Time Vision. This book really talks a lot about what the U.S., what it's going through now with a lot of these curses, and why it's suffering these curses, and also China's rise and China's role in some of these curses. And there's also just so much hope tied into this message. You know, it shows that this kind of theft will not be allowed to go on indefinitely, that righteous leadership is on the horizon. There's actually a really specific scripture in Isaiah 65, 21 through 23 that says, "In the future, after God's leadership is on earth, they shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and eat the fruit of them. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. They shall not labor in vain." So to me, that's just really inspiring to hear that this kind of theft like that China's systematically, you know, systematically executing right now will be a thing of the past.
Yeah. Isaiah's End Time Vision. We'll put a link to that in the show notes for the program. And also, Jeremiah is working on a video about this specific subject, and that will be posted very soon. We'll put a link to that there as soon as that's available as well. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. China is far from being the only power active in the spying business. Last week, Germany opened a new headquarters for its national spying agency. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, this is a big story and a big indication of things happening in Germany, a big indication of Germany returning to world power. Now, that's kind of the if you've been listening to this program, that's what you're used to hearing from us. But on this subject, you don't need to believe me. I'll just read a few quotes on this opening of this new spy headquarters from Deutsche Welle, so prominent German news source. And they say that this move signals a major symbolic change for Germany, no longer shying away from taking a prominent role on the global stage. They talk about how this cost over $1.25 billion. The building covers over 36 soccer pitches in area. They write that it is one of the world's largest secret service bases. And they write that a huge new building in the beating heart of Berlin carries huge significance, a bold statement of Germany's renewed confidence in its global role. So again, that's not my wild words. That's Deutsche Welle. Talking about what a big shift it is for Germany to have this massive new headquarters right in the heart of Berlin.
So give us a sense of what they're hoping to accomplish with this.
Well, a big part of this is bringing the German Secret Service, you know, much more accessible to Germany, much closer to the heart of the capital. So before this building was built, the headquarters of the BND was in Munich, in the capital of Bavaria, pretty much on the other side of the country. So you know, now you're bringing the Secret Service, giving it a much more public role and much more bringing it into the heart of the governance. There was a reason why it was out all the way kind of out in Bavaria. Germany, especially East Germany, with the Stasi, this really abusive communist secret service. And then before then, under the Nazis, the Gestapo, you know, they don't have a good history with secret services. Mm-hmm. And so when the BND were first set up, it was, you know, it was meant to, people wanted it out of sight. They wanted it away from the main organs of government. They wanted it, its importance de-emphasized, having it almost out in the country, out in the countryside kind of thing. So that's one of the reasons. And then you also put this in alongside some other trends in Germany where, for example, very recently they created a new cyber warfare unit. Again, this was a massive unit, a world-class unit. Britain's GCHQ is kind of well-known around the world as being a big and very capable cyber espionage unit. And what Germany was creating was significantly bigger, or is significantly bigger, than Britain's GCHQ. So you're also seeing just a major step forwards in terms of its capabilities with this kind of spying and with other kinds of spying like cyber warfare as well. So you're looking at Germany returning, even as this Deutsche Welle article talks about, returning to some of these, you know, this is kind of hard power, very much more naked and open pursuit of its national interest that it tried to avoid or at least hide and not put on display in the after World War II. Now they're happy to have that in Berlin. Now they're happy to say, yep, we are one of the nations in the world that has one of the biggest spy agencies. We are playing with the big boys now. We're not going to hide that.
Yeah, it is interesting the way you're putting that in historical context, because we're working on this coming edition of The Trumpet. You have an article about how the Nazis went underground after World War II. We have an article by Brad McDonald and Josue Michels and an infographic about how much Germany's industrial capacity gives it the means to transform itself into a major military power very quickly. All of the evidence, when you're looking at this from the historical standpoint, the way that Germany has been able to leverage the resources that it has to accomplish extraordinary things in times past and use them very aggressively, and the way that they've kind of been more quiet about that for some decades now, and yet now we're seeing a more a greater willingness to express that type of power openly. It is interesting. I mean, this really is a watershed moment for Germany in its history.
Yeah, I think when you put it in that even broader context, its significance becomes even more clear. That yeah, they're building up their intelligence at the same time they're doing all of these things in the military. And they've got all of these preparation, you know, the German military is doing more abroad and some of these kind of stories. So, yeah, it really is a return to major power status for Germany. And you mentioned that article in the Trumpet print. The BND figures fairly prominently in that article. It's an organization with an incredibly worrying history. Mm-hmm. You know, it was started by a very senior member in the Abwehr, the German army intelligence during World War II. Its early cadre of leadership and early members were just about all Nazis. It has since then been from scandal to scandal, you know, breaking UN arms embargoes in the Balkans and smuggling nuclear material on a public aircraft, spying on the White House, murky links to neo-Nazis. And then you see this organization being brought into the heart of German government. That's a fairly frightening prospect. I don't know of any intelligence organization that's just quite so scandal ridden as the BND. I mean, there's plenty of organizations that do pretty terrible things, but most of the time, or they're not as frequently disavowed as by their own government as the BND seems to be. Mm-hmm. So a very worrying institution.
Well, we do have an article about this coming on thetrumpet.com. New Spy Headquarters Highlights Germany's Changing Role by Daniel DeSanto, one of our junior writers. And it puts some of this in its historical context, talking about the BND and its history. And do watch for that. That'll be coming up on thetrumpet.com. And keep your eyes peeled for, this would be the April edition, April 2019 edition of The Trumpet magazine. Pretty significant portion of the magazine devoted to Germany and its rising role its industrial and military role in the world today, and pointing back to some of that history, as Richard was just talking about. That'll be coming up within a couple of weeks here on thetrumpet.com. Anything else that you feel would be important for listeners to look at, Richard?
Yeah, less on this specific story of the BND, but just on the rise of Germany, what this means for the world, what the Bible says about it, because the Bible has some very specific prophecies about the rise of Germany, and it was because of these prophecies that Herbert W. Armstrong in 1945 said, you know, watch Germany, they're going to rise again. So our book, The Holy Roman Empire and Prophecy, will take you through those prophecies, talk about that history in light of those important prophecies, and just give you an excellent overview of what is happening before your eyes in Europe, in Germany, and where this is leading, because it is just a key Bible prophecy that's being fulfilled here as we see Germany come from, you know, rubble after World War II to becoming this major power once again.
All right, very good. Thanks for that, Richard. With all the cloak and dagger going on in China and in Germany, a story emerged this week revealing some taking place within the American government aimed at taking down President Donald Trump. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Longtime listeners to this program will know that last year, last March specifically, we had a groundbreaking article from our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, entitled Saving America from the Radical Left Temporarily. We'll put that in the show notes. Some of the prophecies in it are fairly detailed, but it goes through many end-time prophecies in the Old Testament, one in Amos 7 in particular about this confrontation between God's prophet and an end-time leader known as King Jeroboam, and then another one in 2 Kings 14:28 that talks about this King Jeroboam and how God used him to save Israel, or specifically like save Israel temporarily. In the historical type, it was saved for a time and then collapsed shortly after. And this article goes through all this in detail about how God's actually used President Donald Trump to save America temporarily. And then it goes through some of the details of why it needed saving, which have become more relevant this week, in that there was actually like a plot in the federal government and what's called the deep state, like the FBI, the CIA, the Justice Department, mainly these major intelligence agencies, to undermine the results of America's election, put in the Democratic Party candidate as America's next president, and to continue undermining the constitutional freedoms in this nation. Now, miraculously, that didn't happen, and since President Trump's been elected, a lot of these nefarious doings behind the scenes have been exposed. And that's just the latest in that ongoing saga is this interview that the former FBI director Andrew McCabe gave with 60 Minutes. Now, Andrew McCabe was fired last March, around close to the time that Mr. Fleury's article was published, actually, after a report came out about some of the ways that he'd lied to government officials and leaked sensitive information to the Wall Street Journal and other things like that. So now he's on the outside and no longer a government official and free to talk. So he gave an interview with 60 Minutes where he'd actually talked about during his time in the FBI, there were many discussions, he says, many discussions on removing President Trump from office, how the best way to do that. In the 60 Minutes interview, he particularly talked about using the 25th Amendment to oust President Trump from office. Now, the 25th Amendment was passed shortly after President John F. Kennedy was assassinated, and it was supposed to figure out like, what do you do if the president can no longer fulfill his duties. specifically they were worried about, like, well, if President Kennedy or someone like that got shot and it was in a coma, what happens? And they're like, well, if the vice president and a majority of the cabinet decides that the president can't fulfill his duties, the vice president can take over for a while. And so that's what Andrew McCabe's talking about in this. The thing is actually like trying to just get Trump's cabinet together and convince them that he either committed treasons with the Russians or was insane or some other whatever excuse they could think up, mm-hmm. And see if we can get them on board to get him out of office. I guess that's of a little bit of a dubious legality. It would just be up to the cabinet to decide something like that. But they were trying to get them to decide that based off this report that President Trump had colluded with Russia to steal the election or something like that, which, as we've covered in detail on before, that report was compiled by a British intelligence official, former British intelligence official, Christopher Steele, was actually paid for by the Hillary Clinton campaign. Nothing in it's been verified. And now with these leaks coming out, they actually found that the Peter Strzok was one of the FBI agents on that case, had told Andrew McCabe, they subpoenaed his text messages, that, well, we need an insurance policy in case President Trump wins the election. So, I mean, the FBI's like, well, okay, well, he goes to interviews like, we need this insurance policy. So then they work with the Clinton campaign. They found Bruce Orr was actually working with both the Clinton campaign and the Justice Department to get this this phony dossier on President Trump with unverified allegations, and then use that dossier to convince the cabinet that he needs to be removed from office using the 25th Amendment. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is being done by spy agencies, so it gets all very, very complicated, very complex as you try to cover your tracks, as you hire this person to get this dirty information that in case the person you don't want wins the election, you can use it to convince his closest cabinet officials that he needs to be removed from office. And
But I guess as much as this is kind of murky what happened here, in some ways, Andrew McCabe coming out and talking about pretty explicitly, if we can trust what he's saying, that they were deliberately, actively looking for a way to invoke the 25th Amendment to get rid of the president. He's openly speaking of essentially a planned coup d'etat. Regardless of the details that you're speaking about, this is as close to the kind of open evidence of the deep state colluding against the president as we've seen.
Right, right, absolutely. And I mean, now the plot failed, and Andrew McCabe has been fired, and he's a private citizen, and he has nothing to lose by talking about 60 Minutes.
Right,
but
except that he might sell a few more books.
Right, so he's got this might actually go really well for him. But Mr. Fleury brings out in that Saving America Temporarily that if President Trump would have won the election like that, we wouldn't know any of
right.
this.
Yeah,
it would have just been Hillary Clinton would have been put into power, and the Constitution would have continued to have been undermined. Even saying in that article, they think after the assault on the Constitution that happened for 8 years under the Obama administration, that another 8 years under a Clinton administration, and America probably wouldn't have even been a real democracy anymore. These deep state officials would have just gotten so much power that they could rig the election any way they wanted. Because, I mean, it almost... that almost happened in this past election, is that with this information, this that these spy officials paid for from like Russia collusion, they made up a story and then tried to use it to get the legitimate the duly elected president of the United States ousted from office, which if a spy agency can use false information to remove a duly elected president from office just because they don't like his politics, you are not a constitutional republic or a democracy anymore. This is like pure technocracy run by yeah, run by intelligence officials. It's they. I mean, there's a lot of nations like that. Russia's actually one of them, where you get election results, but no one knows. No one knows if they're anywhere close to correct because the nation's run by the KGB.
So look for that article, Saving America from the Radical Left Temporarily, on thetrumpet.com. We also have an article we'll put in the show notes from Stephen Fleury, the U.S. government is at war with itself, underlining the truth that Gerald Fleury was talking about in his article. Quite remarkable to see this going on. And you can also listen to Stephen Fleury's program from this morning, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. He talked about these revelations from Andrew McCabe. We appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, Ayatollah Khomeini's message to Iran on the 40th anniversary of the Iranian Revolution, anti-Semitism increasing in France and Germany, news about more Russian aggression in Georgia, and more. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
We're passing the 40th anniversary of the Iranian Revolution back in 1979, which transformed Iran into a radical Islamic state, the world's top state sponsor of terrorism. Well, according to comments from the Supreme Leader, they're just getting started. For this, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
So it is customary for the Ayatollah to give a speech on the anniversary of the revolution. That is February 11th. The Shah left in, I think it was January 16th, 1979. And then it took a little bit of time for Ayatollah Khomeini to arrive on the scene and then for the revolution to be successful. And that was finalized on February 11th. And so this was the 40th anniversary of that date. And now, according to Khomeini, the next Ayatollah, they are ready for the second phase of the revolution. That is what he titled this speech. It's just really important to realize, and we even talked about this on the Wednesday show for people, that while the revolution was successful or finished, we could say, back in 1979, the Islamic takeover of that nation, fundamentally transforming it from a monarchy to, and a monarchy that was largely secular, that actually banned a lot of Muslim garb and things in public, and was quite Western, to a Sharia state, one that is governed by Islamic law. And so while that took place in 1979, the way that the Iranians see it, as this is a revolution that continues. This is a revolution that is not just for our nation, but this is for all Muslim nations, and then eventually for the whole world. That is the design of the revolution. And this is just one quote. I've got a few quotes to go through from this speech, but just one quote to begin from the Ayatollah. He said this: It is possible to assume an expiry date for anything, yet the global mottos of this religious revolution are exceptional. They will never expire because they match human nature in all eras, he says. And so he's admitting that this revolution will never end. This is a religious revolution. It is a crusade, and we're only just beginning.
And keep on going. What else did he say in this speech?
So this was basically going through the highlights of the past 40 years, and I thought, and it was generally directed to the youth, trying to get them more encouraged about the revolution. They've only known life underneath Islamic rule. They don't know what it was like underneath the Western-backed Shah. And so he was trying to compare and contrast the two and say how great it is right now, with still work to do, of course. And so this is what he said, directing it to the youth. He said, "Now at the beginning of this new chapter in the life of the Islamic Republic, I would like to address my dear young people, the generation who steps up to start another part of the great jihad for building a great Islamic Iran." And then he kind of he goes through a lot of other details that I think went for an hour and 50 minutes. So it was quite long. But he talked about, rather truthfully, how successful the revolution has been so far, to try and really inspire them. And I thought that this was pretty good for him to say, and in a sense that it was helpful. It would be helpful for the West to recognize that although the West has tried to counter Iran for 40 years through different administrations, yes, some more favorable, some not as favorable towards Iran, they have been able to come so far in this revolution. And this is what he said, just comparing the contrasting the early days to now. He said, today, just like the first days of the revolution, sovereign Iran faces challenges from the imperialist, arrogant powers, that of course the United States and Israel and others. Yet there is a meaningful difference. If the challenges posed by the United States those days, meaning at the beginning of the revolution, involved in ending the intrusion by foreign agents or closing down the embassy of the Zionist regime in Tehran or exposing the spy den, which he was referring to the U.S. embassy, today our challenges concern Iran's strong presence near the borders of the Zionist regime. We're not worried about things happening in our country. We're worried about we're actually on the border of Israel to counter them. Then putting an end to the United unlawful infiltration in West Asia. Basically, with that, he's saying we're fighting against the United States in Iraq, in Syria. Then he says the Islamic Republic's support for the Palestinian people's resistance at the heart of the occupied territories, as well as the high-flying flag of Hezbollah. So he's just basically saying that we were concerned about the little Iran. Now look where we are. We have expanded all the way through the Middle East, and our concerns are all in foreign domains. We are strong at home. There's no one changing our revolution. We are going to stay as an Islamic Republic. Then one other thing he said, if then, back in 1979, the West's concern was to prevent Iran from buying basic weaponry, today their concern is to prevent the transfer of advanced Iranian weapons to resistance forces. That's what we reported about all the time. Iran getting their missiles into Hezbollah's hands, into Syrian hands, into the Houthis' hands. Then he says this, one final thing. He said, if on those days the United States presumed that the Islamic government and the Iranian nation could be vanquished with the help of a few Iranian sellouts and a small number of aircrafts and helicopters, today they feel they need a coalition of tens of hostile or daunted states to counter Iran on the political and security fronts, and yet they fail. That's what we talked about in the first half.
Right. Hard to argue
it's
with.
It's not just... It's not just the United States. Iran says that the United States feels they can't do it by themselves, and so they need to branch out to get everybody on board. It shows how strong we are, they are saying, or he is saying. And then he says one final quote. Thanks to the revolution, Iran today stands out and at an elevated position, one that the Iranian nation deserves to enjoy in front of the world, and Iran has already passed the challenging twists on the path of resolving its fundamental issues. They're high-flying right now.
Yeah, so he's reaching out to the young people in the country. You do have to just wonder how much he has their ear, that because there has been fairly high profile resistance among some of the Iranian population, and yet, as we talked about on Wednesday, the determination of the Iranian leadership to maintain this course is really unchallenged, and they have the power, all of the levers of power that they control, and it does seem very clear just how nothing that the United States or any other power to this point has done is going to knock them off of that position. It really does point to what Gerald Fleury has been saying since 1994 about Iran, as we talked about on Wednesday, holding this King of the South position, where it's going to take nothing less than violent, aggressive war to wipe them out. It's not going to happen through economic pressure. It's not going to happen through any of the types of countermeasures that we've tried to use to this point. It's going to take an all-out war.
Yeah, that's exactly right. As hard as it is to say, especially for the people in the region, I mean, in the end, that's what the Bible prophesies is going to happen. And in the end, that's what is this clash between Iran, an Iran-led company of nations ruled by jihad, the ideals of jihad. That is the trigger for World War III. And as horrific as that is going to be, it is the one of those first dominoes that happens till the return of Jesus Christ that puts an end to the war. There is a finite time for that war, A lot of people say it's 7 years. It's only 3.5 years. And then after that, we are going to have an end to it. And so while we do just need to keep on focusing on Iran, because that Iran holds the trigger to the start of the cascade of end time events.
Thanks for that, Brent. Iran and Europe don't have much in common, but there is one trend in Europe that the Iranians likely approve of, and that is the rise of anti-Semitism. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, we've had some stats from three different European countries this week that paint a remarkable picture of rising anti-Semitism in Europe. The biggest stats came from France. They had anti-Semitism was up 74% for 2018 compared to 2017, with 311 incidents in 2017 up to 541. Last year, their interior minister said that anti-Semitism is spreading like poison. Just within the last week or so, there were swastikas scrawled on post boxes in Paris that had a portrait of a Holocaust survivor. There was a memorial destroyed of somebody who was killed in an anti-Semitic attack. A bagel shop that was owned by Jews was vandalized. And then there was a study that found that 44% of the yellow vest protesters that we've been hearing about so much from France believe that there is a global Zionist plot to rule the world. So some of these growing right-wing extremist movements that we see in France and elsewhere have a very strong anti-Semitic component. Meanwhile, in Germany, there were some figures released that showed that according to police records, incidents motivated by hatred against Jews were up 10%. So another rise in Germany after rises in the past that were there were a total of 1,646 offenses. And that was 62 violent offenses up from 37 violent offenses last year. So another big jump in Germany. And then in the UK, the Community Security Trust, which does a lot to protect Jews in Britain, reported a 16% increase in violent anti-Semitic attacks in 2018. So 1,652 attacks, the highest number since they began keeping records since 1984, and the third year in a row where they've had these big attacks. Now, history really sounds a massive warning when you see these kind of rises in anti-Semitic attacks. You saw them rise in global anti-Semitism throughout the 1930s and 1940s. Trumpet.com managing editor Brad McDonald has an article, Anti-Semitism, Why You Should Be Alarmed, that goes through some of this history and just why the history sounds a warning. And then even Bible prophecy has some very specific warnings about an increase in anti-Semitism. So we talk about Psalm 83 a fair bit on this show that talks about a bunch of nations ganging up against Israel, which includes but not limited to the Israel in the Middle East. And it says for them that a big motivation for this alliance is that they want to just wipe that name out. It's not just a case of destroying the country. They hate the name so much they want to wipe it out. And then Jeremiah chapter 8 contains another example where these same powers come in. They hate Israel so much. They hate this history so much that they come into Jerusalem. They dig up the bones of the kings. They scatter them. They try to vandalize them. There's this violent spirit of hatred there for Jews. And so there are some very specific prophecies that talk about this increasing as well. So a big barometer into where we are in world events, and you can read more about that in Mr. McDonald's article, Anti-Semitism, Why You Should Be Alarmed.
Yeah, that's excellent. And I appreciate you bringing out that that prophecy about the tombs of the kings as well. That does give you a very vivid picture of just the kind of animosity that we're talking about and we're seeing increasingly on the streets of these European capitals. Thanks for that, Richard. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We haven't heard much about Russian adventurism in Eastern Europe for a while, but that doesn't mean it isn't happening. It's just that in a world full of splashy headlines, it's subtle enough to occur under the radar. But to learn about this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, media outlets in the former Soviet nation of Georgia reported this week that Russian military forces have built a lookout tower in occupied South Ossetia. This is in an area right alongside the part of the country that remains under control of the Georgian government. And Georgian authorities say that it's only the latest move in Russia's, you know, just its increasing pressure on Georgia. So it was more than 10 years ago now that Russia invaded Georgia and asserted control over about a fifth of its territory. And at that time, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury wrote that Russia's attack marked, quote, the beginning of a dangerous new era in history. And so now here we are a decade on, and there is abundant evidence within Georgia and outside of Georgia also showing that Mr. Fleury's forecast was accurate. You know, within Georgia, it's clear from the way Putin keeps on moving his border deeper and deeper into the country and fortifying it with these towers that we're seeing springing up. And these incursions sometimes advance just a few acres at a time, but they expand the size of the area that Russia controls, and they send a message about who's in charge. And it reminds Georgia that Russia will not allow the country to join NATO. So this new tower is just a small part of that same broad strategy. And then outside of Georgia, we see it with the aggression on Ukraine. We see it with Russia sidelining the U.S. in the Middle East. We even see it with Russia propping up the regime of Nicolas Maduro there in Venezuela as that humanitarian crisis just intensifies more and more. So there's no shortage of indication showing that the world truly is in a dangerous new era, just as Mr. Fleury said it was entering into there in 2008. And in his booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, Mr. Fleury shows just how significant Putin's rule is, in large part because Putin or his office are mentioned in an ancient Bible prophecy. This is a prophecy in Ezekiel 38, verse 2, and it talks about a prince of Rosh, or Russia. And Mr. Fleury says, quote, "We need to watch Vladimir Putin closely. I believe he's almost certain to be the prince of Rosh, whom God inspired Ezekiel to write about 2,500 years ago. We need to watch what's happening in Russia and how Europe responds to it," end quote. And then Ezekiel 38 goes on to show that this prince of Russia will become powerful and aggressive, and he'll come to lead a bloc of Asian nations. And we can already see this happening in its early phases and how it is leading to instability for the world. But Mr. Fleury also shows that there's an astounding amount of hope tied to these developments. He writes, quote, "Vladimir Putin is a sign, literally a sign, that Jesus Christ is about to return. This is one of the most inspiring messages in the Bible. What we are seeing in Russia ultimately leads to the transition from man ruling man to God ruling man. And it's almost here. It's just a few short years away," end quote. So it's clear that, you know, that Putin's leadership is multiplying the dangers around the world, but there's just so much hope tied to this also. So I would encourage anyone who hasn't to go to thetrumpet.com and read The Prophesied Prince of Russia.
And you can also see, in addition to that, in the show notes, we'll put for that booklet a link to a video that Jeremiah has put together on Russian pressure on Georgia intensifies. Go check that out at thetrumpet.com. Thanks very much, Jeremiah. We have one last story. Australians are concerned about China's growing influence in the South Pacific region. To learn what they want to do about it, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison recently visited the small island nation of Vanuatu, where he discussed how the two countries could forge a closer economic and cultural partnerships, possibly even a joint military base. This is one of those pieces of news that you're probably, maybe Australians will, but probably most people in the United States aren't going to see splashed across headlines and papers across the nation. But yet, nonetheless, a very significant. Australia is a nation that's more than most dependent on ocean-borne trade. It's a desert in the middle with a fertile coastland. Most of its goods come through the ocean. It's got two major trade routes coming through the Indian Ocean, three through the Pacific. And this small little nation of Vanuatu is right on one of those major trade routes. It's kind of like a very important like sea gate for Australia. China knows that. And China's trying to increase its dominance in the Australian Pacific region. And so they've lent Vanuatu a lot of money, got them very dependent on China in terms of debt. They're also looking at establishing a military base in Vanuatu and have actually already built an $85 million wharf, which some people have already pointed out seems more suited for naval vessels than cruise ships. I think it was supposed to be, you know, for people taking cruises in the area, but it looks like it's it looks like it was built with military applications in mind. And so this is just another situation to really watch. It highlights a key prophecy in Deuteronomy 28 verses 52 that we talk about in this program often, about the nations of Israel being besieged in all their gates. Australia, America, Britain, these are the nations that are descended from the ancient Israelites, and to besiege their enemies are working like a trade siege against them in their gates, and in particular the gates of the ocean. We've written a lot about the different gates that America is dependent on, but Vanuatu is one of the important ones for Australia that the Australians and the Chinese are fighting for, but the Bible indicates the Chinese are going to get the clinch on.
Thanks for that. We will put a link to the chapter in our booklet, He Was Right, that points to the changing of the guard, a chapter specifically about the transfer of power of those sea gates that Andrew was referring to. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to all the articles and the literature that we discussed on the program today. Email us your thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Jesse Hester. I'll leave you with the words of Edward Gibbon. My early and invincible love of reading, I would not exchange for the treasures in India. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.